Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Kay Heimowitz. I'm a contributing editor at City Journal, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and it is my honor to introduce one of our most well-known and most important social thinkers, Charles Murray. Charles is the author of 9 books. He's the W.H. Brady Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He is a libertarian extraordinaire, a vigorous stirrer of public controversy, a magazine cover boy many times over, and also a detail that perhaps doesn't get adequate attention in his list of many accomplishments, a former fellow of the Manhattan Institute. It was under the auspices of the Manhattan Institute that he wrote a little book, which was to the policy world what San Francisco was to the 1906 earthquake. That book was Losing Ground. One of the pleasures of reading Charles Murray, in addition to a prose style of unusual clarity, is his penchant for thought experiments, a device he modestly admits to borrowing from Albert Einstein. Imagine that you and your spouse died and left your young child an orphan, he has been known to ask. If you had to choose, would you want him to grow up in a rich but cold and miserable family, or a decent, loving, but poor family? Losing Ground was itself a kind of thought experiment. He asks us to imagine a world without AFDC, without food stamps, housing subsidies, and the like. How would the behavior of the poor and the welfare dependent change under such conditions? He invites us to wonder. Now, in the book he has come to discuss with us today, called In Our Hands, Charles leads us into his most ambitious thought experiment yet. Imagine a world not just without welfare or food stamps. We've already been there and done that. Imagine instead a world without Social Security, Medicare, corporate welfare, and agricultural subsidies. Imagine also that we institute what he calls the plan, giving $10,000 a year to every American citizen over 21. By the way, I should call your attention to the subtitle of In Our Hands in case you didn't notice. It is in the usual restrained Murray mode, a plan to replace the welfare state. And Charles, I'm afraid that the word is that the French edition is going to be very, very small. Now, falling into the wrong hands, the thought experiment could easily become little more than a clever writerly trick. But as Charles practices, it is a clarifying device of great power. It asks us not just to examine our own unexamined assumptions, but the assumptions behind those assumptions. And this all leads me to propose my own modest instant thought experiment. Imagine that Charles Murray is not what he is generally described to be, and I'm going to give you only the G-rated version of that, research scientist, data analyst, best-selling author, welfare critic, libertarian, and so forth. Imagine instead that he is really a romantically inclined political philosopher. That means we put aside for the moment the ideas which he has been most closely associated with, his conviction that welfare policy since the 1960s has made life worse for the poor, his mistrust of government bureaucracy, his belief in the importance of IQ in determining success in the contemporary economy, or in the present case, the precariousness of our entitlement regime. Instead, let us consider another subject that sometimes gets lost in the fireworks that tend to greet Charles's work. That subject, the subject that interests him really, is the meaningful life and the good society. Charles starts with a premise that might seem unremarkable. People endow their lives with meaning by living according to their deepest beliefs and by taking responsibility for their actions. Some critics of In Our Hands have argued that the poor cannot be trusted with $10,000 a year. They would waste the money. They would spend it on drugs or gambling. They wouldn't save for later years. But for Charles, this defies principle. The individual must be, as he says, custodian of his life, because this is the only way for him to strive to realize the best he has within himself. Responsibility is not the price of freedom, he writes, but its reward. Responsibility is what keeps our lives from being trivial. The same holds true for community. We are social beings, he reminds us. We need communities that engage us in meaningful connections. The welfare state is problematic, not so much because it increases our taxes or because it is inefficient, but because it deprives communities of their traditionally shared tasks. It saps the life out of civil society. From this vantage point, Charles's brief against the welfare state shares in the tradition of much important thinking on modernity and its discontents. Modern life brings enormous advantages: longer life, greater wealth, more freedom. It also carries the threat of rootlessness and anomy, of spiritual lethargy, and of an unbearable lightness of being. The real problem advanced societies faced has nothing to do with poverty, Charles writes. The real problem is how to live meaningful lives in an age of plenty and security. It is this set of ideas, I would argue, that separates Charles from most social scientists working today. Not his distrust of social policy, nor his politics even, but the presumption that man has a soul and a capacity for imagination, and further, that government has an obligation to respect them both. It's an exceedingly rare thing to find any serious account of human nature and the relationship between citizens and their government among those toiling in the government world these days, which is why I, for one, and I know you all join me, would like to offer him an especially warm welcome this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Kay, but I'm now faced with the prospect of presenting my own ideas as articulately and eloquently as you did, and I'm not sure I can do it. It's really wonderful to be back here. Larry, thanks so much for having me back. I think I have done a speech at the Harvard Club under the sponsorship of the Manhattan Institute for just about every book from Losing Ground on up. And also, this book in particular is dedicated to Joan Kennedy Taylor, who many of you will remember as the director of communications, who called me up one day, way back in 1981, I guess, and asked if I wanted to turn an article that I'd written for the public interest into a book. And she and Bill Hammett were the ones who made all that possible. So it is a very special debt I owe indeed. The book itself is a little book this time. You'll be glad to know. It's not 980 pages long, half of which consists of appendices. It's a short book you can do in an evening. The plan that Kay just described is not much more complicated than she put it, and I will just give you that framework very quickly so you know what we're talking about. The idea is that everything in the nature of transfer payments is cashed out. So that means the big ticket items are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, but also all the welfare programs, all income support programs for low-income people, all corporate welfare, all agricultural subsidies, all of which adds up to about $1.5 trillion a year. In replacement of all that, not an add-on, but in a replacement of all that, every American citizen age 21 and older who is not in jail has deposited electronically every month to a known bank account 1/12 of $10,000. I have only a couple of other details in terms of nuts and bolts. One is, I specify that $3,000 has to be allocated to healthcare. And in the question period, if we want to get into why I do that and issues about how much insurance you can buy with $3,000 and so forth, we can certainly do that. Other than that, you spend the money as you see fit, but you also have placed in your hands, this is the theme of that led to the title of the book, responsibility for your own life. You get to keep any money you earn, this is a very important detail of the plan, up until $25,000 of earned income, at which point you have a net of 35 in effect. And after that time, the government starts to claw back some of it through a surtax, maxing out at $50,000. So everybody $50,000 and above gets a net of 5. Of course, the question is always asked, so I will anticipate it, is, you mean Bill Gates still gets $5,000? Well, yes. Because the ground rule that I set for this is I understand that this idea has no political practicality at all in terms of the current climate, but I have to present a plan which does not ask a majority of the people to vote against their own best interests. and you have people paying large amounts of money into FICA and into Medicare. They're not going to get that money back because I'm assuming tax revenues are neutral. And you got to leave them with something to replace that. So I spend Appendix D explaining to affluent Americans why the government's use of your FICA and Medicare is so preposterously inefficient. You, at age 21, knowing you're going to make $50,000 or more all your life, are much better off getting $5,000 a year than you are waiting for Social Security and Medicare. Those are the nuts and bolts. Now, this is an unusual audience, so I'm going to change my usual presentation a bit, because this consists of trustees, current or past, of the Manhattan Institute, friends of the Manhattan Institute, people who have known my work, been critical in supporting my work in many cases for 25 years ago. And I know that some of them are asking themselves what Charles has been smoking. That here I am proposing an income transfer that Teddy Kennedy could barely conceive of, and I am abandoning, it would seem, a variety of principles that I have espoused in writing over the years about small and limited government. So I want to spend a few minutes talking to those of you in the audience who are asking yourselves that. The rest of you are welcome to listen in. Here's point number one. Income transfers are not going to go away, period. It makes no difference how eloquently those of us who are libertarians write about how well the world would work if we did get rid of income transfers. In a democracy, there will be a built-in large majority, not 51%, but a much larger majority than that, in whose interests income transfers work. You will never, ever change this. Come to grips with that. That's part of it. But there is another more positive way of thinking about all this, which is that this book, in large part, is kind of the policy sequel to the bell curve. The bell curve talked about the falling value of a strong back and the growing value of brains. It also talked about the fact that none of us deserves our IQ. None of us has given ourselves a high IQ through our hard work and perseverance. We are given gifts, some of us, that others are not given. And the people that I have in mind when I propose this $10,000 annual grant isn't a member of the underclass. That's not the person that I have in my head is the guy making $20,000 a year at a low-income job. He's not real smart. He's never going to get much more than $20,000, no matter how hard he tries. He's married, let's say, trying to raise a child or two. He is doing everything right. If he gets $10,000 and his wife gets $10,000, they go from 20 to 40. They go from an existence in which it's really precarious to hold everything together, one in which they have actually a lot of ways to make a life for themselves that is qualitatively better than the life that they can make for themselves now. And so I guess over drinks after dinner we can talk about the philosophical desirability of one's way of doing things over another, but I say to myself, in a country as rich as the United States, I think actually changing that man's life qualitatively for the better is not doing a bad thing in practice, no matter what some of the difficulties in principle might be. And since we're going to have the income transfers anyway, this is a lot better way to do it. And that is what I'm going to try to explain why in the rest of the remarks. However, to my friends from the Manhattan Institute who are still not persuaded, let me just point out a couple of other advantages to implementing this plan. Just think of that great big Department of Health and Human Services building in Washington, D.C. Now imagine one room in which there's a big computer and five people to dust it. And imagine echoing empty hallways everywhere else in that park. I mean, it does make the blood race, doesn't it? And I did back of the envelope calculations that I do not put in the book, because the book does not try to say you're going to get a tax cut. It doesn't try to say we're going to get rid of all those government bureaucrats. Back of the envelope calculations indicate we're talking about 200,000 or 300,000 government employees liberated for productive work. And that all by itself says two things. One, look at all the human capital we're putting into the economy. And the other thing is, look how we're spending the money now. Okay, Why do I think that this is a good idea? Well, there are a few effects that have eluded past social programs that I think can be guaranteed to be produced by this plan. One is that involuntary poverty disappears. Right now, we've been having about 11% under the official poverty line, give or take a percentage point or two, since the early 1970s. Under the plan, nobody needs to be under the official poverty line, but for that matter, nobody even needs to be under a more qualitative poverty line. Just think for a moment about somebody who is working at a minimum wage job, and hardly anybody stays at a minimum wage if they're in the job market very long. Minimum wage job, let's make it even worse. Let's say that there's a terrible economic times and they're out of work for half of the year, so they're only working 6 months. That means they get a net of about $5,000 from their job. Okay, add 10 onto that, you got 15, way above the poverty line for a single individual. But imagine if it's a couple, both of whom are working at minimum wage jobs, they're now at 30, way above the poverty line. Or take the case of people who don't want to work at all. Is it possible for five people to get together and pool their $10,000 and have $50,000 among the five of them and have a perfectly decent standard of living for the rest of their lives supported by the U.S. taxpayer? Yeah, that is possible. They too don't need to be under the poverty line. All of this doesn't mean that some people will not live in squalor. Some people will, because that's the way they behave. But it does mean that involuntary poverty, the kind that should concern us the most, where people are trying hard and are still poor, that goes away. Everybody has access to enough money to put funds together for a comfortable retirement. In this particular audience, where everybody is very familiar with the rules of compound interest and also very familiar with the average rates of return from the stock market in good times and bad, I don't think I need to go into the details of that. But we all know Social Security is a terrible investment for everyone now, and you can take relatively small amounts of money, be lots better off when you retire under this plan than you can under the current one. Healthcare, I mentioned earlier, everyone has access to a package of healthcare. It will not be lavish unless we make other reforms to the healthcare system, three of which I discuss in the book, but everyone will have access to it. Well, getting rid of poverty, providing for comfortable retirements for everyone, and universal health care, some people would consider this is enough for a single plan to do. But in fact, the real purpose of the plan is the one that Kay alluded to. And I want to expand on that in the remainder of my remarks. As she said, I don't think that the most profound problem facing advanced societies has anything to do with poverty. I think it has to do with living a meaningful life in an age of plenty and security. It used to be that finding a meaningful life took care of itself because you had to survive. And to survive, you had to be a member of a functioning community. You had to have, or at least it was very helpful to have, a family and children to help take care of you in your old age. And something else that you had to do, in a way, if you lived any time before this century, you had to pay a certain amount of attention to spiritual matters, because the prospect of sudden death was with everybody all the time. In an age of plenty and security, you don't have to do any of those things. And we have usually think of that as being an advantage. But the trick is that doing those simple things, being a member of a functioning community and being a member of a family and paying attention to spiritual issues, developed satisfactions of their own that lent weight and consequence to human existence. Today, you can, throughout Western Europe, and for that matter in the United States to some degree, almost all of us, go through life with a few social companions, with a few serial sexual partners, having a good time, and die without having any reason to think that you have done anything more with your life than while away the time pleasantly. I think that is the view of life that is taking over in Western Europe. And in this regard, I think that Western Europe offers us a canary in the coal mine that we need to pay attention to. I think the emphasis in Europe on the long vacations and the short work weeks are a very interesting illustration of the way in which work is no longer seen as a central expression of one's life. The plummeting fertility rates, which are way below replacement throughout Europe. It's going to be a geriatric continent very shortly. among the native-born Europeans. That, I think, is symbolic of an age in which people have a cost-benefit calculation about children. And you will hear it expressed when young Europeans are asked about why they aren't having kids. Well, you know, if we have the kid, we can't afford the vacation home in Mallorca. And then they will also say, what good are they anyway? They're a lot of trouble, kids are. That's a direct quote from one interview I was looking at. The idea that children are a central expression of one's life and one's marriage is disappearing. In these ways and others, well, secularism in Europe is the last example. No civilization in history has been nearly as secular as Europe's. The churches are absolutely empty. It's not a function of modernity. The religion is alive and well in the United States. In Europe, it's gone. I think this is dangerous. And the reason it's dangerous is I think that whiling away the time as pleasantly as possible is a very boring way to spend a life on one level and a deeply unsatisfying way to spend a life on the other. And to me, the idea of getting to be the age of 70 and looking back on who you have been and what you have done must involve in its answer that you can be proud of that because you have been engaged in important activities. And if you start to think about what those important activities might be, there are not a whole lot of them. I think there are basically three clumps of them. One is vocation, another is family, another is community. And here's the catch in all of this. For the people in this room, especially when we were all young, vocation was the way in which we saw ourselves as living a meaningful life. In some of our cases, we wanted to be excellent at our chosen craft. In other cases, we wanted to become rich and famous. But whichever of these things was motivating us at the time, it was work that dominated our sense of this is why I am being all I can be. I think it's probably also fair to say, looking out over the people in this room, that as we have gotten older, we may still take satisfaction in our vocations, but the other two, community and family, have become more important in many ways. But what is true of the people in this room is not true of a very large chunk of the population. It is not the case that you can find satisfaction in vocation no matter who you are. I do not mean to say that you have to be in Wall Street, God knows, or a physician or a social scientist to have a satisfying vocation. I think being a really good mechanic is every bit as satisfying. Being a really good woodworker, being a really good wide variety of things, but not everybody can do that either. Half the population is below average in intelligence. I will say that without fear or favor. And half the population is below average in diligence, and below half is below average in charm and in beauty and everything else. And a lot of people are below average in a lot of those things. And so the question then becomes, you've got to have a society where they have access to deep satisfactions in life. Those will not come from vocation. They must come from family and community. And that leads to the question, how is it that family and community are vital institutions? The answer is they are vital institutions insofar as they have the action, insofar as all sorts of important social functions have to be dealt with in those loci. And as Kay said, Kay took some of my best lines in her introduction, actually. But as Kay said, the real problem with the welfare state isn't that it spends so much money. It is that it drains too much of the life from life. The welfare state says of a wide variety of things, we'll take care of that. Now, it doesn't take care of that. The problems still persist, but it is a very human reaction to say, well, if they're going to take care of that, I'm not. It's not a conscious decision. It's just a displacement effect. It also removes the importance of a lot of things that people do. And I will give the example I first used in a book I wrote in 1988 when I was still with the Manhattan Institute, I think applies today. Imagine somebody who is working on a loading dock, making $10 an hour, hard work, not very satisfying. Can he say he is doing something important with his life? Well, if he can say, if it weren't for me, my children and wife would be in terrible trouble, he is doing something important with his life. You don't have to have a propaganda campaign to tell him he is. He really is. And if His wife and children would be economically just as well off if he stopped working. He is a chump. That's the kind of contradiction at the heart of a lot of social welfare policy. Is it a good thing to provide for women and children who are in need? Yes. But if you, in the process, destroy one of the key ways in which the husband is living a satisfying life, who is the winner in all this? Well, what you want to do is to enable a whole lot more people to take responsibility for their lives and at the same time provide resources whereby they can live a decent existence. And so the plan that I have offered, I think, is the way to go. It will not happen next month, will not happen next year. Politicians will never do it as long as they have any choice whatsoever, because I am gutting the basis of their political power, the power to redistribute goodies. But there are a couple of factors working in favor of something very much like this eventually happen. One is the continuing secular increase in wealth. At the end of the book, I have a graph showing real per capita GDP from 1900 to 2004. And it has the individual little dots for each year, and then it has a mathematically fitted line, which is a very clean exponential increase in real per capita GDP. And it's amazing how small the space is between the individual dots and the line. So even though you have a president who you think is the best or worst thing to happen in economic policy in years, in fact, not much changes over the long term. Assuming that our leaders are not quite as incompetent as the Soviet Union's, we will continue to see a secular increase in growth over the next few decades. At some point, it will become obvious to everyone what I think should already be obvious to us all. The lack of money cannot be the reason we still have poverty and other problems. It is because we are spending the money badly. And it will become obvious that there is so much money sloshing around, we can afford almost anything. The second thing that I think will become obvious over the course of the 21st century is that government is inherently incompetent. I apologize, Mr. Mayor, for... I meant except for New York under his administration. It is remarkable how few governments in history have managed even the easy tasks. The easy tasks are providing for a national defense and a legal system and criminal justice system. Those are easy, and it's been very hard for governments even to do that much. When they then progress into trying to deal with more complex human needs, they can't. It's not because bureaucrats are lazy or because they're unmotivated. It goes to some very basic principles of how institutions function when they do not have to elicit the voluntary cooperation of the people they are dealing with. The Salvation Army can't function unless it elicits the voluntary cooperation of the people it's dealing with. Neither can families, neither can communities. And all of these things, you establish interactions in which you ensure that the human needs that you're trying to deal with are dealt with in ways which are getting responses, because otherwise you have a feedback loop which makes it work. With government institutions, you don't have to elicit their voluntary cooperation, and everything breaks down. Well, the fact is that none of us chooses a government service over a private one whenever we have a choice, just about. Whether it's a package that we really have to get there tomorrow, in which case we do not use the United States Post Office, or whether it's choosing the fast food place across the street from the government office building rather than going to the government office building cafeteria. Almost any service you can think of, private institutions do it better. That too is going to become obvious. And at some point, people are going to say, if the institutions we like to use are always private ones and private arrangements work best, might that not be true of the kinds of institutions that serve complex human needs as well? So my parents both lived to be into their last half of their 90s. I'm only 63. That gives me a little time. So I'm not planning on being vindicated anytime soon. But I do have hopes that sooner or later I'll be able to say I told you so. Thank you very much.
Charles will answer questions, and I'll let him acknowledge people, but it's a big room, so please wait for them. There's two mics. Please wait for them to come. But I do want to take the privilege of asking the first question. You talk about conservative or libertarian reaction. I wonder what the reaction of liberals is to your proposal, because there's not a day that goes by in the New York Times where we hear that the vast majority of Americans aren't sharing in this growth of wealth. How do they respond to your solution to that problem?
They are conflicted. I have had a couple of progressive groups which have advocated something like a basic assured income, which are quite enthusiastic about trying to find common ground, which I'm very happy to see. But the other kind of reaction I am getting is embarrassment. I'm not saying all people on the left feel this way. A great many really truly believe that the average person can't be trusted to run his own life. And they are absolutely, in their heart of hearts, convinced you got to stage manage their lives for them to protect them from themselves. And I'm kind of smoking them out on this. And I think that's one of the virtues of the book. Here's what I'm doing. I'm proposing a grand compromise. I'm saying to the left, you want generous support for the people who are disadvantaged from the low end. I'm saying, okay, you get big government in terms of expenditures. What I want is small government in terms of the government's ability to stage manage people's lives. Are you willing to do that? And interesting reactions. Yeah, Brett.
Charles,
wait for the mic.
Charles, I actually wrote a paper back in 95 called Blueprint for Economic Justice when last we were visiting the welfare reform debate in the United States. It's extremely similar to your proposal, with one caveat, and I want to get your feedback on that. It, instead of giving checks to everyone, it gives money as refundable earned income tax credits to people who are working, and that proposes getting rid of the minimum wage. So I have an opportunity for everybody to work with very high returns for that work. But that work's not, if you will, the return is not a function of a mandated minimum wage that may price out some labor, but rather you end up having the government benefit come in. It would seem to me by connecting this benefit to work, you go further along the line of incentivizing people not to create that five-person commune and just live on the checks.
Some of the objections are practical, and that is the earned income tax credit, which of course is very popular, is also subject to a lot of fraud. There are a number of government studies which indicate that an awful lot of people who are claiming the credit don't deserve it. They're never audited. There are, to the extent that you do enforce it, you provide all sorts of incentives to go off the books in your work. And so part of it, in principle, I'd say, yeah, there are advantages to the way you want to go. But the kind of system I'm proposing has the only kind of fraud there can be with my system is if you are fraudulently able to prove you're a U.S. citizen. And given the sophistication that we have now for, and I'm afraid it works out to be a national identity card, but the technological sophistication we can now have for that sort of thing, that can be pretty much minimized fairly easily. We can have a foolproof national identity card that establishes your eligibility for the grant. So I guess I would say in practice, mine is going to work out a lot better. It will create a lot fewer of these subterranean distorted incentives that I think the earned income tax credit involves. Yes. And then I'll work toward the back of the room on the next question.
Thank you. The Economist had a recent article on what they called soft paternalism. An example of that is we don't want people smoking in public places because it's not good for them, so we're going to tell you what's good for you to do. Would you comment on that growth or direction?
Unfortunately, the plan doesn't do a thing for that sort of I just imagine there are such things as unintended consequences. Suppose that we had all of this urge to manage people's lives that is now divided between keeping us from smoking and eating fatty foods and between monitoring the welfare of low-income people, and all of that urge was transferred over to monitoring our intake of fatty foods. That's pretty scary. There is a possibility that the regulatory urge is hardwired in certain people, and they will move into it. However, if, look on the bright side. By the way, I don't mean to be facetious. I'm very upset by all of these attempts to be a nanny state. To the extent that people start to say, you know what, let's just give people the money. That translates real easily, and I think appropriately, into people say, you know what? Let people make their own decisions about their lives. So your right to swing your arm stops where my nose begins, but we're going to have fairly strict definitions of where your nose begins. Your nose does not extend 5 feet out into space. And there is a lot of room for individuals to do things that other people think are dumb. We'll let them do it. So I think the popularity of this plan will spill over into that kind of attitude. Okay, I'm going to go toward the back, right there. Yes.
Thank you. I certainly agree, Charles, with your feeling about welfare being a frustrating way to get ahead. However, there are so many people who have suffered because of getting welfare, I think around the same time as you started your book, I was working on it, Jane Vorstein.
Yes, yes.
And found that there are people who, generation after generation, just don't know how to spend money. And so what would happen to this $10,000? What sort of transition are you thinking about?
Well, I think what you want to do is not imagine this as $100 bills given in a brown paper bag at the beginning of the year to people, but think of it in terms of this deposit every month. And I think you're talking about feedback loops. So you now have a situation where somebody has blown the money. They have no idea how to spend money, let's say. They hit 21 and they've got some money now. They blow it all. Well, conversations will take place. There's no place to go to apply for food stamps. There's no place to go apply for other housing subsidy. You are going to have friends, maybe a spouse, maybe a girlfriend, maybe relatives, maybe neighbors, maybe local agencies that you need to go to for help. Well, they are able to behave in a way towards you now that they, under the plan, they can't do now. Which is, they can say to you, buddy, yeah, we aren't going to let you starve in the streets. Next month, you better start thinking about making some better decisions. That kind of pressure will start to be put to bear. And the person no longer has the option of saying, there's nothing I can do, you know, there's no jobs, etc. Yeah, you're getting a check every month. Deal with it. I think that there is going to be a very rapid educational process. I also do not believe that people are mindless or subhuman with regard to understanding over time their own best interests. I have in the book what I call the Doolittle effect, after Alfred Doolittle. I cannot tell you what a relief it is to be in front of a crowd that is likely to know what My Fair Lady was about. I've been speaking to campus audiences and I'm getting blank stares. Remember Alfred Doolittle? Dustman, good member in good standing of the underclass, never bothered to marry Eliza's mother, works as little as possible, and then is recommended to an American philanthropist as the most original moralist in England, and is given a large bequest. And Alfred then laments to Eliza that he now has 50 relatives he never knew he had before, and there's not a decent job among the lot of them, he is now forced into middle-class morality, and worst of all, he now has to marry his girlfriend. And as I was trying to figure out in my mind, as I was writing the book, I said, you know, there's going to be strange kind of pressures on young men in the inner city because they have an income stream. And I'm saying, I'm something like that. I know I've read someplace, and all at once, Alfred Doolittle. Well, that's it. It's going to be real. There is going to be a way in which you cannot evade responsibility. I am giving you responsibility whether you want it or not. There is a much more simple level, by the way, which I will emphasize, in which you get a much more direct effect on incentives in young men, that I will mention because it's going to be so transformative. Suppose you get your girlfriend pregnant. Low-income guy, no job, or you can disappear. Child support laws don't work with you. Under the plan, you've got a known income stream into a known bank account that any judge can tap with a court order with 100% efficiency. Think that's going to have an effect in the calculation of little boys who are watching their older brothers spend all their money supporting children that they've sired? I think so. For that matter, it will also have a very large effect on young women who are looking at their older sisters, some of whom are spending their grant on an apartment and education and clothes, and others whom are spending their grant on diapers and baby food. So you've got big changes in incentives there. But my overall statement is, You want to think about the effects of this plan in dealing with people who have not handled their lives well, not with them sitting in isolation trying to think through their lives de novo. You have to think of it in terms of being in a social nexus in which everybody else has these resources and everybody knows that you have your resources. Yes, well, two, you choose. we'll come up to you on the next one.
Thank you. I think the most original aspect of your argument is the one that posits that the whole decline of society is somehow related, as I believe it is, to the introduction of wealth on top of wealth on top of wealth that creates the need for, that takes away the need for society to be a functioning organism. And I think that argument alone should be the subject of another book with anthropological evidence and so on. I think it's that important. But I don't see how your solution doesn't do more than extend the attenuation that occurs with the wealthy society, because it doesn't connect work or other constructive behaviors to the access to the money. It permits the kinds of behaviors that you decry, and so do we, to take place on a larger scale. Could you comment?
Sure. Rephrasing your language, work disincentives have always been one of the key thing about income floors. And I am drawing from an idea that was originally proposed by Milton Friedman, the negative income tax. And when we tried an experiment in that in the 1970s, we found that an income floor has huge work disincentives, because as if you start taking back the income floor as soon as people go to work, people are working for 90% marginal tax rates, and no reasonable person will do that. That is why I let them keep everything until $25,000. As I put it in the book, I lure them into working until they can't afford to quit. Because by the time they're at 25,000, making a net of 35, nobody's going to trade that, hardly anybody, for 10. Then the question arises, well, how many people are going to be happy only making $10,000 a year? By the way, note one of the other beauties. I'm becoming increasingly, the more I talk about this plan, the better I like it, you know. it doesn't, you know, there's no incentive to get an off the books job, except the incentive which exists now to avoid taxes. But as far as the grant is concerned, whether it's on the book or off the books, it doesn't make a difference, you still get the money. So you're talking about people who only want 10. Well, will there be anybody like that? Yes, there will. A lot of them will be the same people who are already out of the labor market. But once again, think of it in terms of what I call status rewards. Call them status rewards way back in Losing Ground. And that is that within low-income communities, historically, there were all sorts of distinctions made between people who were doing the right thing and people who weren't. So you didn't have to be rich, you didn't have to have a high-status job to be considered a pillar of the community. People divided up who you were and how you acted on the basis of good and bad within low-income communities. And I think that it is not idealistic to say that after this is in effect, status rewards will be revived. And yeah, you can be one of these, you know, no-counts who is just living off the $10,000 and scuffling trying to get along. You'll be looked down upon. You will be stigmatized in your community. And stigma is a very powerful social force. So I think that if we ever get to the point where we think about passing this, you put a whole team of econometricians together to calibrate the work disincentives as accurately as possible. But I think on the face of it, they aren't going to be that bad, and they are going to be counterbalanced to a very large degree by the kind of reconstruction of status rewards I'm talking about. And there was a gentleman right up before that, yeah.
You mentioned citizenship before, which of course brings up the issue of non-citizen immigrants who consume some of the resources and some of the programs that you mentioned, and as we're learning, have quite a significant political constituency in this country these days. So I'm wondering how you treat non-citizen immigrants, and if they don't get any of these payments, how do you deal with arguments that, for instance, they are a burden on our healthcare system and therefore require things like Medicaid allocations for them and such things?
It's going to be very clarifying, won't it? Because it will force us to confront, all right, here's what citizenship means. That's one thing it'll do. A second thing it will do is to restore the self-selection system that formerly produced a very high quality of immigrant to this country. It used to be that before the welfare state, that if you wanted to come to the United States, you could come, but you had to rip yourself up from your homeland, come to this strange place, had to learn English, and you also had to make your own way because there was nothing there for you except what you could do on your own. That is pretty much going to be restored by this. And everybody will know it is, so that all at once, coming over to the United States across the border, and I would like to think that by that time we would have secured our borders, that's part of the deal. There's nothing there for you, except from private voluntary organizations. And at that point, I'm not worried about whether we can deal with the human needs that exist, because it's going to draw a certain kind of person, point number one. Point number two, there will be a very active private sector to deal with a lot of this. And I think we're back to a much more positive system than we are now. Up here in front, yes.
My question concerns health care.
My question concerns health care. You're setting aside $3,000, which is roughly half, I think, of the health care expenditures per capita now. How do you account for the need extra care, particularly with an aging population and with catastrophic illnesses of various kinds?
I had the advantage of, when I was working with the book, that one of the former chairman of the AEI Board of Trustees, where I am, was the chairman of Cigna Corporation. And he was able to tap into a variety of resources at Cigna when I would ask him questions. The fact is that if you are talking about a long-term commitment to a healthcare company, and you're getting in at the age of 21, and everybody is getting in at the age of 21, you'd be surprised how much healthcare you can get for $3,000. It's the same reason that you can buy cheap life insurance if you get in at 21, because they're making a lot of money off the young, healthy people and paying it back when they get old and sick. However, the healthcare system is deeply dysfunctional the way it exists now. So all I can claim is that if no other reforms are made, the $3,000 will provide a very basic package. If we'd had three simple reforms, the healthcare system would be transformed, and the three reforms are as follows. First, all insurance companies are required to treat the entire population as a single pool, risk pool, and to sell individual life insurance at the same rate that they sell group life insurance. And of course, if the entire population is a single risk pool, then that also becomes more feasible. Reason for doing that's really simple. The genetic explosion in knowledge means that people whose parents have multiple sclerosis are gonna face catastrophic costs in health insurance, and people who don't won't. And if there is anything that is cosmically unfair, I think it's getting certain genes rather than others. And it's sort of like no-fault insurance and throwing everybody in the same pool. Reform number two, make the value of employer-provided health insurance taxable. That pretty much gets rid of a whole lot of employer-provided health plans. And reform number three is to change tort law and licensing so that a vast amount of routine health care can be provided without the involvement of a physician. A great proportion of the things that healthcare consists of, the vast majority of things that healthcare consists of, should be getting cheaper rather than more expensive. The technology, yes, it produces really expensive machines that do new things. Those infect very small proportions of people. All of us are affected by, let's say, blood tests. Now, how do you do blood tests? It used to be you had somebody staring into a microscope counting red blood cells. Now you pop the thing into a machine, and it's all done automatically. All sorts of things should be getting cheaper. There is one area of medicine in which they are: cosmetic surgery, not covered by insurance usually. So if we have reforms that all at once have the consumers of healthcare being the people who pay for it, either directly through their insurance, indirectly through their insurance, or directly by going to the doctor's office, I think you have a revolution in the cost of healthcare. Very quick answer to a very complicated issue. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Those of us who are appalled by the cost of government and the lack of congressional restraint in spending heard you say that due to political pressures, entitlements slash wealth transfers are here to stay. What is to stop our friends in Congress from saying, gee, 10,000 is a swell idea, but our constituents would like 30,000 three times as much?
There are a couple of things regarding that. The first has to do with the other tendency of Congress to say, well, gee, the 10,000 is working fine, but there are still these people who are wasting their money, so we'll have a mini food stamp program. Now, there I specify at the beginning of the book that there has to be a constitutional amendment written in language that even the Supreme Court cannot ignore, saying thou shalt have no transfer payments before thee except this one. And when people ask me, is there anything in the book that you say to yourself, I don't really think we can do that, that's it. I don't know. I don't think you can write a constitutional amendment that the Supreme Court can't misinterpret. But you know that you'd have to do that. I'm less worried about jacking up the size of the grant a whole lot. And the reason I'm less worried is because right now, as Manker Olson and other economists have taught it, the reason you get getting all these increases is that you have constituencies that really, really want the benefit, like sugar farmers, and there's not a unified body of people who really care that much about preventing them from getting it. If you change the $10,000 by so much as a dollar, it is going to be the lead story nationally, politically, because the change in the size of that grant is going to affect everybody, including those who are paying in taxes that subsidize it. And I think there is going to be very powerful political pressures to moderate the size of the grant. So I'm less worried about that than I am rebuilding a separate welfare state up alongside the grant. That one really scares me. Right there.
It seems to me that the flat tax idea or the VAT idea has kind of won the intellectual argument, but isn't about to happen because of the accounting profession, the legal profession, all sorts of vested interests. Assuming your argument wins intellectually, how do you deal with the vast establishment out there that, as a practical matter, would resist it because they view their own interests as being harmed?
Yeah. Actually, I guess I go back to Losing Ground as my ray of hope in this. When I wrote Losing Ground, the last chapter had what, as Kay said, what would the world look like without AFTC, without other welfare supports? And I presented that as a pure thought experiment. In fact, I introduced that whole part of the book by saying, I don't have any practical ideas for solutions, so since I don't, let's talk about some impractical ones, which just goes to show I haven't changed much over the last quarter of a century. Well, we did have the Welfare Reform Act of 1996, and it certainly wasn't perfect from my point of view. It was also not even on the radar screen in 1984 as a possibility. And what happened there, despite very powerful constituencies, extremely powerful ones that wanted to keep the system the way it was that the conventional wisdom changed. And that's powerful. What if the conventional wisdom becomes, this is absurd, sending all this money to Washington and getting this little bit back that then dribs and drabs. Just give them the money. That's a real simple idea. That's an idea that has a potential for becoming what, who was it called, a certain ideas, damn right ideas, people that will finally say that's damn right, and once you do that, then it's politically unstoppable. It isn't now, but it may become a damn right idea, and in that case, there is, in our track record, a history of bringing resistant institutions kicking and screaming to a new way of doing business. Been wonderful to be back at the Manhattan Institute lunch. Thank you.